last speaker of today is one of the people we should thank for organizing this program and the conference, Abai, who will speak about quantum geometry of isolated horizon and black hole thermodynamics.
Okay, so since this is a rather mixed audience, I thought that I would begin with a rather very general summary of the whole picture and then go into some details. And I hope that the experts in the audience will, you know, forgive me for this long summary. So, I want to begin first with the motivation of what the problem is. The problem is that of finding a microscopic description of the states of a event horizon of a black hole, or in general of a black hole, and account for the entropy in that particular way. So let me sort of explain this point in a little bit more detail. Well, in the early 70s, it was found pointed out first by Bekenstein, and then detailed work by Bardeen, Carter, and Hawking, that we have actually, purely within classical general relativity, without reference to any quantum effects at all, these remarkable laws to which black holes in equilibrium, by that we just mean in classical relativity, stationary black holes. They found that there are these remarkable laws to which these stationary black holes are subjected by just equations of Einstein's theory. The first one says that the surface gravity of such a black hole is a constant. The second one says that if I went from one equilibrium stage to another equilibrium state, then the change in the mass is related to the change in the area by surface gravity upon 8 pi g plus some work terms. And the third law says that, and the second law says that the change in the area is always positive. So there is a striking similarity between these laws and with the laws of thermodynamics, where the temperature is constant, where the first law which says that delta E is equal to TdS plus work terms, and the second law which says that delta S is bigger than or equal to zero. So this striking similarity suggests that kappa should be perhaps thought of as a temperature, and area of the event horizon should be thought of as entropy. However, there were immediate problems, and even Stephen Hawking himself, when he first heard about Bekenstein's ideas, for example, and maybe Jim can correct me, but even after this work was completed, thought that these results were exact results within general relativity, but there were really formal analogies, and there was not a deeper content to them, so to say. And the reason for that is because, really, within classical general relativity, we cannot, for example, make area to be entropy. Entropy is dimensionless. Area has dimensions of length squared, and there is no natural length in classical general relativity. Similarly, we cannot really think of surface gravity, which is 1 upon length, it does not have the same dimensions as temperature. So, however, then, very soon afterwards, in 1974, Hawking discovered this effect. This effect had to do with doing quantum field theory in the background, which is a black hole geometry, so it's a quantum field theory in curved space-times. This is not a quantum gravity, only the matter fields are quantized. But nonetheless, now h bar is not equal to zero. And then Hawking found that the black holes can actually be, when you do the problem appropriately, with the incoming states being the vacuum states sky minus as past null infinity, one actually finds that black holes actually radiate as if they were black bodies, and the temperature of this radiation seen at infinity is in fact given by kappa h bar upon 2 pi. Then it seemed very natural to assume that this temperature of the radiation one could identify to the temperature of the black hole as in black bodies. And then if you make this identification that T is equal to kappa h bar upon 2 pi, then one can go to the first law up here and sort of conclude that we should really think of the entropy of the black hole as being area upon four Planck length squared. GH bar is Planck length squared. Okay. So that we have exactly this numerical factor, 1 upon 8 pi g up here. But this reasoning is sort of compelling, but on the other hand, it is a rather hodgepodge mixture of ideas coming from classical general relativity and from quantum field theory in third space-time. And it is rather reminiscent of what happens in Bohr's model of atom, of a hydrogen atom. But again, there are hodgepodge ideas coming from various things. The final result was compelling, particularly because in those days one knew about the spectrum of the hydrogen very much in detail. But nonetheless, it was not conceptually satisfactory. And so now our challenge is really to account for this entropy from first principles, that is to say, from, say, quantum gravity. So we can ask, for example, what are the relevant building blocks? When we do the entropy calculation, we look at the microstates. And, for example, in ordinary statistical mechanics, if you have gas in a box, these microstates are molecules. For a radiation in a black body, they are photons. For a magnet, you think of it as a spin system. And then we do statistical mechanics with these microstates. And from there, we account for the entropy. So the big question then is, what are the corresponding microstates for black holes? Well, yesterday in these two beautiful string talks, in the very first session, we heard about how this comes about in string theory. And in particular, these microstates, or these elementary excitations, are really associated with excitations of deep brains in string theory. And these deep brains can be thought of as matter in some sense, because it's matter fields. I mean, they actually contribute to the stress energy tensor, for example. But here, in this particular approach that I want to present today, these in fact are quantum excitations of geometry itself. And so this is the big difference, that the microstates now are going to come from looking at geometry in a quantum mechanical setting. So what are the main ideas? And as I said just a minute ago, I'm going to spend a few minutes trying to explain the overall picture and then go into some details about how that picture comes about. The key ideas are the following. First of all, the first idea is that in this particular approach that John sort of touched on in his talk, one sort of looks at gravity in the following way. So one takes this Einstein's theory of general relativity very seriously in the sense that one says that the central lesson that we have learned from that is that gravity is coded in the very geometry of space-time. And therefore, if you are going to have a quantum theory of gravity, it should also be a quantum theory of geometry. And so quantum gravity should lead us to a quantum theory of geometry. We should not really presuppose that there is a background space-time geometry, background space-time metric that is given to us, and then things happen on that particular background. But to do this, one needs really a fully non-perturbative approach. And this was developed systematically in the years 93 to 97, in particular, this detailed mathematical approach to describe quantum geometry. Some of it was clear in John's talk. You'll hear much more about it also in Carlo Rovelli's talk tomorrow. But for the purpose of this talk, what is important to note is that there is a rather detailed understanding now about the quantum nature of space geometry, spatial geometry. The quantum nature of the space-time geometry coming from spin forms has begun. But for this talk, I'm not going to rely on that. And now the fundamental picture that comes about is that the fundamental excitations of this geometry are really one-dimensional, and therefore we have got a polymer-like structure. This is in quotation marks because it's not meant to be in any detailed sense. And the continuum picture only arises as an approximation. And in particular, if you compute some geometrical operators like the areas of regions, or areas of surfaces, volumes of regions, or lengths of curves, the eigenvalues of the geometrical operators are discrete. And then this immediately suggests, as John was hinting, that if in particular the eigenvalues of this area operator are discrete, perhaps one can account for the entropy of the black hole in terms of this quanta which make up the area of the black hole surface itself. And I would like to argue in this talk that this is indeed the case. So the idea is that at the Planck scale, at the microscopic scale, right, the fundamental excitations are one-dimensional. Geometry doesn't look like a continuum picture at all. However, if you coarse-grain it and look at its scales, which are very large compared to the Planck scale, then the ordinary continuum picture that we are familiar with arises. The second sort of key ingredient here is what goes under the name of isolated horizons. And this comes from just classical gravity. This is a whole topic by itself, and I know there are many classical relatives in the audience, and if there are more questions about it, I'll be very happy to answer them during the talk. But basic idea is the following, that if you look at the interface of general relativity, quantum field theory, and statistical mechanics, then that interface, these laws of black hole thermodynamics or laws of black hole mechanics that I just mentioned, that interface is not restricted to stationary event horizons and certainly not restricted just to near extremal black holes. For example, one may not have event horizon, one may just have cosmological horizon. You may have De Sitter space-time, for example, and in De Sitter space-time there is no real singularity, but there are cosmological horizons, and using Euclidean methods, people were led to associate temperatures and entropy with these horizons, and one would like to sort of have a more general unified picture which incorporates not only the event horizons of familiar black holes, but also these cosmological horizons. The second thing is that one might look at situations which involve realistic collapse. For example, if I have a star which collapses to form a black hole, this is just classical general relativity at this stage. In the early stages, there is going to be a lot of non-stationarity, and there will be some changes of multiple moments up here, and that will give rise to a lot of radiation. However, one expects, and we heard about this in the talks today, that at late stages in the gravitational collapse, in fact, the black hole will settle down, and the intrinsic geometry of the horizon up here at late times would be pretty much time independent. And so this is what I would mean by an isolated horizon. So this whole space-time does not have to be stationary, but there is a causal boundary to the space-time, which is time-independent, and I'll satisfy certain conditions, which I'll specify as we go along. But it turns out that, in fact, one can generalize laws of black hole mechanics, particularly the zero and the first law, in this much more general context, namely that of isolated horizons. So this is what is classical gravity telling us, that there is this much more general setting, and therefore the natural question is, can we combine now the ideas about this polymer geometry, about this quantum geometry, and the ideas about these isolated horizons, and really talk about microstates of such isolated horizons and account for the entropy. And it turns out that one is actually able to do that. One is able to account for entropy of all these solutions, all the solutions of Einstein. In this case, I'm going to talk about Einstein-Maxwell theory. In the talk, I'm restricting myself to Einstein-Maxwell theory. And the relevant parameters are the radius of the horizon or the area of the horizon, the electric charge, the magnetic charge, and possible cosmological constant. However, so far, all this work is restricted only to non-rotating isolated horizons, non-rotating black holes, if you like. Just during this workshop, some progress was made due to some recent work of Lewandowski. He did not really talk about this work in the workshop itself, but this recent work that he did actually opens the door to do to generalize what has so far been done for non-rotating black holes to the rotating case. Okay, so what is the final picture that emerges out of all this? Out of all this putting together. So what we would like to do is to look at these two ideas, that the geometry is quantum, it looks like a polymer in some sense. The fundamental excitations of the geometry, they can be thought of as flux lines, and one can ask then, what are the flux lines of? And then, as John pointed out, remarked briefly in his talk, these can be thought of as flux lines of area. So for example, if I were fundamental excitations of geometry, which really are given by the holonomies of connections along such lines. So if the geometry is excited just along this line, for example, then it will assign to the surface some unit of area. As John pointed out, that these flux lines themselves carry a level, angular momentum level, which is a representation of AC2, and the precise value of the area then depends on the level that this particular line carries. So we want to put this together, and then we want to have a final picture of a black hole horizon. And the final picture is that the horizon can be thought of as a pinned balloon. So you can take a balloon full of water, say, in the middle of this room, and you can suspend it, or you can make it rest it on using some blunt fins out there, right? So these are the fins, if you like. These are the fins up here, which these are the things that support the balloon. And then this balloon, the surface of the balloon, however, you can go and poke it, and it can vibrate, it can oscillate. However, these oscillations are constrained. They're not random oscillations. They're not sort of the normal modes of the unconstrained balloons. They are going to be the modes associated with the balloon, which is constrained. There are some points, the pinning, where the balloon is not supposed to move, but then everywhere else, if you like, it can, in some sense, it can wobble there. And that is a very general, vague physical picture that one can carry with oneself. And the idea is that these degrees of freedom, and I'll be much more precise as we go on, these degrees of freedom on the surface of the horizon are what accounts for the entropy of the black hole. So the idea is the following, that we have got an exterior geometry in a three-dimensional space up here. We have got this exterior geometry, and that is all well described by some of these polymer-like one-dimensional excitations. Again, many of you have heard these analogies before, but there are people here, particularly mathematicians in the audience, who may not have heard these things. The general analogy is, for example, that of a fabric. If you look at a shirt, then the fundamental threads, fundamental building blocks are one-dimensional, but for all practical purposes, is a two-dimensional continuum. And the idea is that the space around us is exactly like that, namely that one has actually fundamental excitations which are one-dimensional, like these polymers, but they fit together to give us, that are so small, at some small scale, that then if you only probe large scales, then we can approximate what is going on by a continuum picture. So these are the bulk excitations, but these excitations then go and puncture this horizon. And as we saw up here, you can think of them as being flux lines of areas, and here is the surface, the horizon, that they're actually going and hitting, and as a result, to each little element, if you like, of the surface of the horizon, they're going to assign an area. And so these punctures assign an area to the horizon. A typical puncture would assign, it doesn't have to be this way, but typically it would assign, say, about Planck length squared of area, then we need lots and lots of punctures. So for example, if you have a solar mass black hole, then you need something like 10 to the 76 punctures, huge, huge number of punctures. So the idea is that these excitations go and puncture the horizon, give it an area, and they also constrain the quantum fluctuations of the intrinsic geometry of the horizon. Now it turns out that if you put everything together, the intrinsic geometry of the horizon is described in this particular quantum theory, this particular way of quantizing geometry, by what is called as a Chern-Simons theory, a U1 Chern-Simons theory. Again, for more astronomical people in the audience, we're not going to need any details of the Chern-Simons theory, but let me just say a couple of sentences. This is a theory which is also diffeomorphism invariant. If you have a three-dimensional space-time, then you can write down, and if you have a connection, so if you have taking values in the Lie algebra of any compact Lie group, then you can write down an action, a natural action, which is diffeomorphism invariant, and then one can look at that theory. And that theory actually has turned out, it's a very natural theory to consider, and it's turned out that it has very beautiful and nice applications. In terms of physics, the applications, a lot of applications have been in condensed matter physics, and in terms of mathematics, there have been a lot of applications to knot theory. Using Chern-Simons theory, and using, for example, so one can consider Chern-Simons theory, and one can have excitations, which are really Wilson lines, but these excitations may be knotted, and using Chern-Simons theory, one can compute some partition functions and things, and expectation values of Wilson loop operators in this Chern-Simons theory to get hold of knot invariants. So it's a very pretty and nice and natural mathematical theory that is sitting out there, and what we'll see is that this theory arises rather naturally when you look at black holes. And now what I hope will be clear in the talk would be that there really is a very delicate interplay that goes on between the three things, general relativity, isolated horizons. These isolated horizons, boundary conditions tell you that there is a Chern-Simons theory on the horizon. On the other hand, if you take general relativity and go to quantum theory, you get quantum geometry, the areas are quantized, and finally, the final quantum picture that we're going to have is going to come from these two sectors here. And again, you can calculate certain quantities purely in quantum geometry, and you can calculate them separately in terms of Simon's theory, and there is a very delicate matching that is possible, which makes this whole picture hang together and give us a coherent, consistent description of the quantum geometry of a horizon, a horizon in the sense of isolated horizons of general relativity. So that is the summary, and that is what we want to do. The talk then is organized as follows. We're already through with the introduction. In the second short part, I will tell you about what the isolated horizons are. Then I will tell you a little bit about quantization. And finally, I will do the entropy calculation. The specific work I'm going to present was done jointly with John Byers, Alex Corici, and Kirill Krasnow. And in fact, the final touches on this work, some of the touches were put during this workshop. And this uses earlier ideas of Krasnow and Rovelli. So let's begin with the main part now, and let me tell you a little bit about isolated horizons. Again, I'm going to be rather brief in my presentation of isolated horizons. It's a subject by itself. You can worry about how do you get laws of black hole mechanics for these things and so on. But for our purposes, I just want to give you a general idea of what these isolated horizons are. As I said already, they include the event horizons of all the non-rotating black holes that we know, and also cosmological horizons. So the idea is the following, that you are going to look at a space-time which has an internal boundary. And again, because I had already used this picture, I put it back to sort of fix the idea. This is only an example. So you might have late stages of collapse, and then this inner boundary is going to represent the isolated horizon. And the space-time of interest would be this triangular region up here, bounded by null infinity, this inner boundary, and some partial Cauchy surface that is coming in here. So the idea is the following. What is the idea? The idea is that this is a horizon and that it is isolated in the sense that there is no radiation or there is no matter field falling into that horizon. Now, how do we incorporate these ideas to technical conditions? So the idea is that the internal boundary delta that we have is going to be null and it is going to be expansion free. So the area of the two this is null boundary, so you can just look at two sphere cross sections, and the areas of those two sphere cross sections is just constant. The topology of this boundary is S2 cross R. It's assumed to be S2 cross R from the beginning. So the expansion is zero, and there are some further conditions which ensure us that the angular momentum associated with this isolated horizon would be equal to zero. Again, I'll be happy to go through some details in the question period if there is interest. The interesting thing here is to say that first of all, this is a quasi-local notion. It is not like that of the event horizon. In this particular example, this is a part of the event horizon. But the definition is just formulated quasi-locally. So, you know, if you give me a surface in a given space-time, I don't have to look at the evolution of the whole space-time. I can look at that surface and decide whether or not it is an isolated horizon. It's a quasi-local notion, and the space-time itself need not be stationary. Nonetheless, one can associate things like mass and charges in this case with these isolated horizons. And now, what we want to do is to finally look at the entropy calculation. And I think there's often some initial confusion, at least, about entropy calculations, because once you specify a priori what the general setting is. And the general setting is that we're going to say that given that there is an isolated horizon, what is the entropy associated with it? Or given that there is an isolated horizon, can I describe physics near it or away from it, etc., etc.? So the idea up here is that we're going to start in the classical theory by looking at space-time. So the whole phase space or the space of histories I will consider, each history will have an isolated horizon, and which has an internal causal boundary. And then the idea is that we're going to take this class of space-times, construct a phase space out of it, and then we're going to quantize just that sector of the of general relativity. We're not quantizing the whole general relativity and then finding out if there are isolated horizons. Rather, we are introducing the notion of isolated horizons, certain boundary conditions, construct the phase space, and then quantize that theory. And that is the idea. So now if I look at Einstein-Maxwell theory with these isolated horizons, then one can look at the action. The action has a bulk term, which is sort of the standard bulk term that we all are familiar with. Then, however, if it's asymptotically flat, then the bulk term itself, the action is not differentiable. In other words, you would not get a proper variational principle, and therefore we have to add a boundary term at infinity. Then you do the Lagrangian transform. The bulk term just gives you the act from the Lagrangian. You can recover the Hamiltonian. The bulk term gives you a volume integral of constraints, and the term at infinity gives you the ADM energy or the ADM energy momentum at infinity. But now, in addition to that, because we have an internal boundary, we can check if in fact this action is a good action. Is it really differentiable with respect to variations of the internal boundary? And you find that the answer is no, and therefore we have to add another boundary term. And this boundary term turns out to be a U1, as I already mentioned, a U1 Chern-Simons action. So by U1 I mean it's just a vector field, like Maxwell field, you know, it's a vector potential, no internal indices, and the action is just the vector field, rather the co-vector field, one form, V dV, that is the action up here that is coming up. And in the Hamiltonian formulation then, there is the taut Hamiltonian is bulked up with a constraint, there is a term at infinity, and there is a term at the isolated horizon up here, and that term will give us the mass of the mass associated with the isolated horizon. So this is the general picture up here. In a minute I will comment on the geometrical meaning of this particular connection, so you can have your, from the relativity perspective, you can have your ideas fixed. And so, but however, the important thing is that we did not sort of want this Chern-Simons term. I mean, we began with boundary conditions which were motivated very directly by causality and by various requirements coming from general relativity, and these requirements then, you know, we put boundary conditions, and those boundary conditions then give us, so to say, this Chern-Simons term. So there is an unexpected interplay between classical general relativity, the isolated horizon boundary conditions which come within this theory, and the Chern-Simons theory. Now, as I mentioned, in order to do quantum theory, we want to pass to a Hamiltonian description. So we need to construct a phase space. And the phase space, in this case, is where we only know how to do quantum theory so far in terms of certain variables. So these are the variables which are better suited for quantization, so to say. And the variables that we are going to use are going to be connections. This is like the ones that John introduced. This is just SU2 connection on a three-dimensional surface up here. And a conjugate momentum. You can think of it as in Yang-Mills theory. This is a connection. You can think of this as an electric field. However, in general relativity, this electric field can also be thought of as a triad. And this dual interplay between Yang-Mills theory and general relativity has a very rich consequences. In the most of my talk, instead of looking at this triad, which is actually vector density with the vector field up here, I'm going to look at its dual. I'm going to take its dual, and I'm going to look at the two forms that are obtained by, it's a three-manifold, so if I take a dual of a vector, I get a two-form, and I'm going to be dealing with two forms. So in the most of the talk, E will refer to the two forms. Okay. So now, the boundary conditions, you go and look at the consequences, and now where is this V coming from? Well, we got this connection in the bulk here, and the boundary conditions tell us that the free part of the connection, which is not fixed by the boundary condition, is all contained in this abelian connection, this vector field V, which lives on this boundary edge. In terms of this big picture, in the space-time diagram, H is just the intersection of a partial Cauchy surface with the horizon. So H is like these two spheres up here, and in this picture, H is these two spheres up here. Now, what are the boundary conditions? Well, there are many boundary conditions, and this is a very intricate subject, but the key boundary condition is the following. Oops, I just ignore this at the moment. The key boundary condition is that you take this two form, okay, which is a triad two form, if you like. I is just going from 1, 2, 3. So I get three two forms. And the boundary condition just says that if I take this connection and I compute its curvature up here, so this connection is just living intrinsically on the horizon, and I take its curvature, I get a two form. That two form is the same as taking the radial internal component, looking just at the radial internal component of this triad two form, multiplied by 2 pi times area. So this is the key boundary condition. So the phase space consists of these fields subject to certain boundary conditions, and then we can compute what the Poisson brackets are. Or, in a more geometrical language, we can ask for what the symplectic structure of the theory is. And then the symplectic structure turns out to be, in the bulk, this term gives us the usual Poisson bracket. The term at infinity, as you all know, does not really give you any corrections to the Poisson bracket. That does not give you any extra term. But somewhat surprisingly, the term at the horizon does give you contribution of the symplectic structure, and not very surprisingly, this is precisely the symplectic structure that is the standard symplectic structure for this topological Chern-Simons theory, which lives on this horizon. Finally, what is the geometrical interpretation of this important connection V that is left over on the horizon? As I said, it is, so to say, the non-trivial information contained in this spin connection that we have up here. But when you look at the boundary condition in detail, you can see that what this is just the following thing. We have got the horizon, which is a two-surface, and therefore there are dyads, you know, that you can construct on this two-surface. So there is a natural SO2 connection that lives there. This is just the associated U1 spin connection. Associated with that SO2, you have got a double covering that gives you U1, and this is just the U1 spin connection associated. So this is really the spin connection on the horizon itself, intrinsic two-sphere spin connection of the horizon itself. Okay, that actually is all I wanted to say about the isolated horizon, the classical part, and now let me begin with quantization. So now, what we want to do is the following. There's going to be, in quantum theory, the symplectic structure, the total symplectic structure is given by the bulk plus the surface symplectic structure. That kind of suggests, I mean, this is a very, you know, quick motivation, that suggests that the total Hilbert space we should consider of states, there should be a bulk Hilbert space and there should be a surface Hilbert space. And then the detailed considerations show that this is really the right starting point, that we should really look at the bulk Hilbert space and a surface Hilbert space. And the bulk Hilbert space is the one that John introduced already. It is basically the space of square integral functions of connections that we discussed. And this is quite well understood, and this is what gives rise to these polymer excitations. And these polymer excitations, as John explained, can be thought of as Wilson lines or holonomies associated with this SU2 connection A that we have. John also mentioned the following thing. This whole thing is well understood. However, in this quantization, there is a one-parameter family of quantization ambiguities that arises. And this really has to do with the fact that to begin with, one has a non-compact group which comes from SL2C, basically. From there, one passes to SU2 and so on. But there is a quantization ambiguity in the process that arises. And the ambiguity is labeled by one real parameter, gamma. And this is the so-called Imirzi parameter. And what this means is that we have got some operator algebra, which, for example, consists of operators like areas and triads and volumes and so on. And these operators are represented by self-adjoint operators. These abstract operators are represented by self-adjoint concrete operators on these Hilbert spaces. But these representations are all unitarily equivalent, and there is a one-parameter ambiguity up here. And this algebra, this ambiguity is labeled by the parameter gamma up here. In certain senses, and I can specify this in detail in the discussion if you like, this is a little like the theta ambiguity that exists in QCD. In a certain well-defined sense, this is really like that ambiguity up here. In other words, you've got a classical theory, and that is unambiguous, but when you go to quantum theory, you get inequivalent representations of the operator algebra. Now, the qualitative features of the geometry are the same in all the gamma sectors. So it's not that you get completely different physics. But what happens is that the eigenvalues of the geometrical operators, these are all discrete, and they are different from one gamma sector to another gamma sector. In fact, this is how we first realized that these were unitarily inequivalent, because we got these operators, and the same operator has different eigenvalues, and these are all discrete. But for example, this is something that John showed already, that if you look at the area operator, then the eigenvalues here are 8 pi times Planck length squared times gamma, this real number, times summation or I, j into j plus 1, where the j's are just half integers. So we got this quantization ambiguity. And again, as John mentioned, if one could actually measure the minimum quantum area, for example, by some experiment, then we could say that, oh, in the real world, we live in this particular gamma sector. But we don't really have hope of doing that directly, and therefore the idea is to use black hole thermodynamics for that purpose. I should say that this whole work on the bulk theory was done by a large number of people, and here is basically the list of some of the main contributors. Okay. So that is the bulk theory, and now what we want to do is to talk about the surface states. So the total Hilbert space is going to be given by the bulk states times the surface states. But they are not separate. I mean, we know what the bulk states are. These are the bulk states. We know what the surface states are, because the surface states are going to be precisely the states of the Chern-Simons theory living on that two sphere. Okay? So one can just take the tensor product of the two and, you know, sit there. But that's not the point. The point is that all the interesting stuff happens. In other words, the whole meaning of this horizon boundary condition and so on comes into play because of the interplay between the volume states and the surface states. They're not just separate. They really are interplaying, and that is what makes the whole structure rich, and that's what gives us a very detailed picture of the quantum geometry of the horizon. Now, how does this intertwining occur? Well, they're intertwined by the boundary conditions. Well, on the horizon, classical relativity tells us that we have got these are the triad two forms, if you like. The radial internal component of the triad two forms is given by the curvature of the connection of one form which lives on the horizon. But when you look at it in detail, it turns out that this side is really a bulk operator, and this is the curvature of something which lives on the Chern-Simons side, therefore this is really a surface operator. So basically, we're saying a bulk operator should be equal to a surface operator, and this is a condition that we have to impose on the theory. It's like having two particles, and we're saying that only those states are allowed of two particles for which one operator operating on the first particle has the same net effect as an operator operating on the second particle has. This is a very strong condition, because this means that although the bulk operator itself is allowed to fluctuate, the surface operator itself is allowed to fluctuate, the intrinsic curvature can fluctuate, the intrinsic curvature of the Chern-Simons connection can fluctuate, the triads can fluctuate, however, the two fluctuations are really correlated. Now, so we want to solve this on states. So to begin with, we have got this sort of say, kinematic Hilbert space to begin with, which has the bulk times the surface states up here. This is a bulk operator, so this operates only here, its identity here. This is surface operator, so this operates only here, its identity here. And we want these two things to be equal to each other. And then the only possibility for this equation to have solutions is that this is an eigenstate of this operator, this is an eigenstate of this operator, and they have exactly the same eigenvalues. Right? Because on the right-hand side, and here I'm not touching the bulk operator at all, I'm operating on the bulk operator, bulk state. While here I'm not touching the bulk state here, I'm just touching the surface state, whereas here the surface state is left invalid. But now, from quantum geometry that John sort of outlined, we know what the eigenstates of this operator are. Now, this is a key point, so let me just sort of emphasize that this is a bulk operator, so the bulk theory tells us what the eigenvalues up here are. And the eigenvalues are, as John said, some number, I forgot the immediacy parameter gamma up here, some number times you get here the following thing. If in fact these polymers go and hit the surface, make a puncture, I get something. If they don't make any puncture, I get zero. Therefore, there is a delta distribution. So I'm looking at the operator E hat of x, and there's a delta of x and p, where p's are the punctures up here, times mi. So what are these mi's? Well, we got this angular momentum quantum number associated with each of these edges that are coming in. And here, I'm just taking the radial projection of it. So it's like the z component of the angular momentum, if you like, except that in this case, z happens to be radial, r up here. It's just component along the radial axis. And therefore, these mi's just go from minus ji to plus ji. So the eigenvalues of this operator are just of this particular form. Therefore, we are forced to conclude that for this whole picture to work, it better be true that the surface state, which should say goes hand in hand with this bulk state, should be an eigenstate of the Chern-Simons field operator with exactly the same eigenvalue. And here is a tension that is building up, because Chern-Simons theory never heard of quantum geometry. Chern-Simons theory only heard about the symplectic structure, and once you tell me the symplectic structure, all the eigenvalues of the Chern-Simons field operator are completely determined. So now, a key question is, we already know the symplectic structure, so does this field operator admit these eigenvalues? If it does not admit these eigenvalues, that would mean that we have no solutions at all. That would mean that this whole idea of having quantizing, looking at the quantum geometry of horizon in this particular way, the bulk intertwined with the surface, with the boundary conditions which came from isolated horizons, that just would not work. That just fails. And the very non-trivial fact is that, in fact, the surface Chern-Simons field operator has exactly these eigenvalues, including the numerical factor. And this is really possible because of the exact numerical factor that comes up in the symplectic structure of the Chern-Simons theory, which came from classical general relativity. So this is the level k of the Chern-Simons theory that we are left to look at here from classical general relativity is this. So in order to have this coherent non-trivial quantum theory, we have to have classical general relativity giving us a level, Chern-Simons theory then giving us eigenvalues of this operator, and quantum geometry giving us eigenvalues of this operator, and everything coming together, and everything clicks. Therefore, there's a coherent picture up here. And now we can say, okay, this is a nice picture. What is the quantum geometry of the horizon that thus arises? Well, the quantum geometry of the horizon that arises is the following. This F up here, the curvature up here, every surface state up here that we're looking at is an eigenstate of this curvature operator with a given eigenvalue. But these eigenvalues are distributional. So F is zero except at the punctures. And at the punctures, it is distributional. It is given by the two-dimensional delta distribution up here. So basically, the picture that we are led to is that in quantum theory, unlike in the quantum classical theory, the horizon is a smooth surface and there is curvature is uniformly distributed. In quantum theory, the picture we are led to is that, in fact, the curvature of the horizon is just concentrated at these punctures. It is flat everywhere up here. And at the punctures, there is a deficit angle. And that deficit angle, you can work out, it is precisely given by 2 pi upon k times this n, n being this quantum number up here. And so all these little deficit angles are quantized, but then they all add up and give us the geometry of the two sphere. So this is the final picture of the quantum geometry that we are led to. So I'm now coming to the last part of the talk. This is the quantization part that is over. And now I want to tell you about the entropy calculation. Oops, maybe I should put it there. Okay, so this is one. So now let me summarize what we have to do. Little a delta?
Yeah.
A delta is just the area. This is about. Just one second. So let me summarize where we are. We started with classical general relativity. We introduced the notion of an isolated horizon, which generalizes the notion of standard event horizons of black holes. That is sitting there. But that leads us to consider some boundary conditions, general relativity with certain boundaries. Then we looked at the Hamiltonian formulation, and this boundary condition led us to a particular phase space in which the field satisfies some boundary conditions on the surface itself. And also we have a symplectic structure. The symplectic structure in the bulk is the standard symplectic structure of general relativity. On the surface, there is a Chern-Simons term. Then we went to quantum theory by looking at the total Hilbert space being bulk times surface. This we knew how to quantize before, and now we are focusing on the surface states. And these surface states are going to be the Chern-Simons states up here. And then what we saw was that not all possible elements up here will satisfy our constraint, but only those which are simultaneous eigenvectors of this operator, and that gave us the quantum geometry of the horizon. And now what we want to do is do this particular calculation. So let me now tell you what this A delta, which is appearing everywhere, is. So the idea up here is that we've got this horizon. We're looking at a particular system. And the system we want to look at is general relativity. Okay? That sector of general relativity consisting of all bulk fields which admit a horizon with an area which is fixed, and that is A sub delta. Delta stands for the horizon and A is fixed, so we just get A sub delta. And also the charges are fixed. The electric and magnetic charges are fixed. So this is our system that we are looking at. And we consider all these fields, the bulk, with these fixed things. And this is what is defining for us the quote-unquote microcanonical ensemble that we want to consider. Okay. And the microcanonical ensemble then is constructed as follows. So we want to count now the relevant microstates, that is to say microstates associated with the surface. Because in this isolated horizon scenario, there will be a lot of matter fields outside, there could be radiation outside, and we are not interested in the states associated with that radiation. We are only associated with the states which are tied to the quantum geometry of the horizon. So the ensemble we consider the following. First, take these two surfaces, which is the inner boundary, and you consider punctures. And there are going to be n punctures, P1 up to Pn, and at each puncture, these particular polymers which go and intersect it have associated angular momentum quantum numbers, half integers, J1 up to Jn. So let us look at such punctures up here. Given an ensemble of such punctures, the Burke geometry gives us the possible eigenstates of area and eigenvalues of area, and the associated eigenvalues are just given by 8 pi intrinsic parameter Planck length squared times summation over I, j times j plus 1. So these are the eigenvalues, and in our ensemble we want to allow only those eigenstates of this area operator which has eigenvalues which are close to A delta, which is large fixed number with dimensions length squared. So we just consider bracket A minus A delta minus epsilon, L delta plus epsilon, where epsilon is of the order of Planck length squared. Then the idea is that you construct the Hilbert space of Chern-Simons states, which are all, so given any bulk state up here, given any J's up here, we have a whole bunch of M's which are allowed, and then therefore we have got a whole bunch of eigenstates of this operator that are allowed, and that will expand some Hilbert space of the surface states. And now the idea is that we just want to count the number of dimension of this space. So for a given puncture, which satisfies our constraint, we construct the Hilbert space, we count its dimension. Then we change our punctures, which still satisfies our constraint, and we again count the dimension. And finally, we consider all possible such punctures which satisfy our constraint, we add up the dimension, and that dimension will be the total dimension of the surface space that we have. You can also do it slightly more abstractly and perhaps more satisfactorily by at least formally constructing a density matrix. The important thing is that in this whole picture, classical as well as quantum, this is an inner boundary. The horizon is an inner boundary. We don't know what is going on inside the horizon. But we know what is going on outside the horizon, and therefore we could take all the states which satisfy our constraint, you know, the bulk states as well as the surface states. We can construct a density matrix by summing over all possible bulk states, and then we will be left with a particular density matrix on the surface Hilbert space, and you can take the trace of rho log rho, and that of course again will give us precisely this number that I have up here. Now so we can calculate this number and ask what is it equal to. And it turns out to be equal to, the logarithm of that number turns out to be equal to area upon 4 LP squared, this is the answer we want. But we knew that we can't really get that because there's always this gamma ambiguity in everything we are doing. And indeed, in all this work, gamma always appears as a multiple of Planck length squared. And so we obtain gamma times Planck length squared, and we obtain a precise numerical coefficient here, which is given there. So we don't obtain Hawking-Bekenstein formula for arbitrary values of gamma. But on the other hand, if you fix the gamma, then this is the formula, irrespective of the value of the electric charge, the magnetic charge, or the cosmological constant. It only depends on the area up here. And this has, yeah. No, this is a total. I have summed over the whole thing. It is dominated by states of the following type that we might have the maximum number of these punctures and each having the minimum value of j, which is j equal to plus equal to 1/2. That's what dominates. That's what will give you that final answer. Right, exactly. But of course, I could also have all of them having j equal to 1/2, but only two of them having j equal to 1, and so on. But that only gives us a logarithmic correction. Right, exactly. Okay. So that is the answer that one gets. And now we have to interpret this answer. And the idea is the following. So first of all, entropy is proportional to area, but there's something about numerical factor up here, which is not entirely satisfactory. On the other hand, we could not hope to have it entirely satisfactory because the whole thing is a gamma ambiguity from the beginning. So the zeroth level viewpoint is the following. And so to say, it's the viewpoint about doing phenomenology. Anytime you have got quantization ambiguity, you sort of do experiments and you fix that quantization ambiguity by experiment. Here there's exactly one parameter that is free for us. So we can do one quote-unquote experiment, and as Gary, I think, said, that Hawking effect and black hole thermodynamics is our experiment that we want to do. And so the idea up here is that we look at this isolated horizon, and as I said, that this is an infinite-dimensional space of in the phase space up here, and in that there are many finite-dimensional subspaces. For example, you've got De Sitter subspace, which is one parameter family. You may have Schwarzschild subspace, which is one parameter family. You may have Riesz-Nossdamm with a given value of mass subspace, and that is a one parameter family, and so on. So what we can do is we can just go to one of these points, say Schwarzschild, with mass M1, say, for example. And then we say that, well, let's fix this gamma so that you get an agreement at this particular point. But of course, if I do that, that will just say gamma should be equal to gamma naught, work in that particular sector, then that fixes the value of gamma, and then we can say that now we can go and do, so to say, check at every other point, and of course, at every other point, since this number did not depend on Q, P, or lambda, you will get an agreement with the Hawking-Bekenstein formula. So these are zeroth order viewpoints, and of course, there are many. This is the least understood part of this particular calculation, and there are many viewpoints about what, you know, how to improve this. So let me just make a few remarks, and then I will ask somebody. A few remarks about. Is this visible from back, or is it better that I put here? I guess not very visible. Okay. So now the idea is following. So first of all, it may be possible, and this is something that also came out during this workshop, it may be possible to combine some ideas that Carlip has been advocating, which are very universal, very general ideas about counting of black hole entropy, counting of states, which will lead to black hole entropy. And basically, Carlip's idea is that one should really focus on certain symmetries of the theory and look for a conformal field theory on which the symmetries are implemented, and then for very general arguments, you can look at the number of states in this conformal theory, and if your symmetries are the right ones, then the number of states will give you the Hawking-Bekenstein entropy. So that is the general idea. Now it turns out that it seems that this idea can actually match very well with the isolated horizon boundary conditions. There really is a symmetry on the isolated horizon boundary condition of the type that Carlip would like. But that we had never looked at before, because somehow we are more interested in constraints and other things, and we're never worried about implementing that particular symmetry. So it could be that by requiring that you implement that particular symmetry in a way that Carlip would advocate, that one would actually fix completely this gamma. And if in fact we are able to implement it the way that Carlip advocates, the value of gamma would be equal to gamma naught. In other words, the number of states that we will get will be precisely 1/4 times the area in the Planck units. The second thing is that the entropy here is associated with surface degrees of freedom. So they are really, in some sense, quantum fluctuations of the horizon that have to do with all those deficit angles at the horizon up here. And so these are the states, these are the degrees of freedom which can interact with the exterior. However, so in that sense, it sort of has some feel of an entanglement entropy. But I want to emphasize that this is not entanglement entropy in the usual sense of the word, because when it is not calculated by tracing over the internal degrees of freedom. We never looked at internal degrees of freedom from the beginning. We did not have a whole Hilbert space, including the interior, and then traced over the interior. Okay. This sort of is very intriguing and very striking. And this is a remark that, again, I think came up in yesterday's two talks. That there do seem to be some striking similarities with the pictures that emerge from string theory. In string theory, I mean, in both talks, we saw pictures of membranes and then strings hanging out from those membranes. Right? And there was tension on those strings, etc., etc. Here, we have got, and furthermore, those membranes had gauge theory sitting on them. Here, we have exactly that scenario. You can think of this horizon as being a two-brain. And we can think of these one-dimensional excitations of the polymer geometry, if you like, they have the same pictorial representation as the strings. And furthermore, to make it even more interesting, in fact, all these degrees of freedom are coming from a gauge theory, which are living right on the horizon itself. But as usual, I mean, you know, you draw these pictures, one gets excited, but then one also realizes the key differences. The key differences are that, the standard key difference that sort of comes again and again at us, which makes detailed mathematical matching between the two approaches difficult, which is that over here, that everything that we are talking about, the two brains and the gauge fields, they really refer to the geometry. This is not the matter field. This two brain is the horizon. It is really the geometry. It's the two brain made up of geometry itself. This gauge field is not a matter field which contributes to stress energy, etc. It is precisely the spin connection. It's really geometrical associated with this horizon. That is why in my early first transparency I said, well, the difference is that rather than looking at the matter degrees of freedom, here one is looking at the geometrical degrees of freedom. So this is a spin connection and this is not a matter. Now it may be possible to put surface degrees of freedom in the matter. Okay. For example, one might say, well, can we make a contact? Can we solve so on? Now if you went go to the extremal black hole case, right? If you go to the extremal case, then indeed it is true that this curvature that I was writing down, the F that I was writing down, is boundary conditions everywhere. This F up here. This curvature up here is sort of the curvature I mean here. That curvature has contribution coming from Weyl tensor and has a contribution coming from the Macquer tensor. In the extremal case, the Weyl tensor contribution is zero on the horizon. And what we have is precisely the Macquer tensor contribution up here. And therefore, it's sort of very tantalizing that maybe perhaps one can redo this calculation completely. In other words, the way we did this calculation was putting degrees of freedom in geometry. And the reason we put degrees of freedom in geometry is because if I had no matter, if I had uncharged Schwarzschild black hole, you know, where am I going to put them? And I better put them in geometry. But as usual, with these, you know, with these boundary conditions and gauge fixing and such things, there is some latitude. So it may be possible, I don't know how to do it sort of immediately, but I think it may be possible to redo this calculation just in the extremal case where the degrees of freedom are really put in the matter and then see what happens in some sense. Quantize the matter, so to say, not the geometrical degrees of freedom, and then what happens up here. But this will be possible in this approach only in the extremal or perhaps near extremal cases, because as I just said, if you're away from, you know, if you're a zero charge, then the only degrees of freedom we have are going to be in gravity. In that F, the only thing that contributes is psi 2, the Weyl tensor. So, here the relation to the exterior curve geometry is clearer than in stringy calculation. And this to most relativists, you know, is a very satisfying feature that in fact we're not doing some abstract calculation counting states in some theory out there which has never seen a black hole, and then doing some doing some interpolation by tuning up the coupling to talk about the black hole situation. But I think this is also the weakness of this approach, and the reason is because if you wanted to do something like this information loss issue, one wanted to really analyze it to the end, so to say, it's going to be very difficult in this approach without, you know, changing something at the very base. And the reason is because precisely that in order to have contact with the geometry, we are always looking at large black holes, and in the near, you know, in the final stages of evaporation, this kind of picture that we have will probably fail. And so I don't know exactly how to do this. So let me now just go to the last transparency with summary. Okay. So what entirely within classical general relativity, there's a notion of isolated horizons, which enlarges the notion of stationary event horizons of black holes. Killing fields are not necessary and it is quasi-local. There will be a talk in one of the contributed sessions by Chris Beetle more on isolated horizons. In this case, all isolated horizons in the entropy calculation are treated at once. There is no restriction of near extremality, and therefore ordinary astrophysical black holes, you know, like Schwarzschild kind of, are actually included. However, so far, rotation has not been included. Cosmological horizons are included. There are some other examples that are also interesting. Surface states arise naturally within Einstein-Maxwell theory. We are not sort of taking this theory and then extending it by putting some new matter of degrees of freedom by hand, so to say. We are always remaining within Einstein-Maxwell theory. The variational principle doesn't give you any new equations. It gives you only Einstein-Maxwell equations. The variational principle, to be well-defined, Einstein action plus boundary condition, we had to add a Chern-Simons term that changed the surface Poisson brackets. That on quantization gave us this boundary term, and that says dynamics has been used. I mean, we are really referring to Einstein action. If we had a higher derivative theory, one has to redo this calculation completely. There is a very delicate interplay between general relativity, quantum geometry, and Chern-Simons theory, and for this overall coherence. Finally, I just listed some of the open issues, by no means a complete list. The first and sort of the obvious is inclusion of rotation. And I already mentioned this work of Lewandowski, which at least lets us begin in the classical regime the extension of the notion of the isolated horizons to include rotation. Then, of course, this is sort of say so far it's just entropy calculation. Now, what happens in dynamical processes or quasi-dynamical processes about Hawking radiation? In this case, it literally is true that the Hawking radiation would amount to conversion of quanta of area into quanta of matter. The black hole shrinks, loses a quantum of area, and that is radiated away in the form of quanta of matter. So we have got this this polymers, so to say, and this polymer might just branch off, for example, and that process would be like converting geometry into matter up here. And one can even see what is at zeroth level, what is happening. One can say that, well, I mean, there is all the curvature here is really concentrated on the punctures. As Ted Jacobson likes to sort of point out, that this Hawking process can be visualized in terms of tearing away because of tidal forces of particle antiparticle pairs, and therefore it won't be surprising if this in this picture that since the curvature is concentrated here, that this tearing away also occurs at this puncture. And finally, and I think sort of the deepest and the most important issue in the whole subject for me at least, is really better understanding of this parameter gamma. I already mentioned to you about us via the symmetry. One might be able to fix it via the symmetry argument of Kalip, but I think once it is fixed, one should also have other checks on this gamma, value of this gamma, coming from, for example, not black holes, but quantum field theory in curved space-times, etc., etc. Thank you.
Just to play the devil's advocate.
Please.
The fact that you get the number of microstates e to the area isn't surprising, since, of course, you're considering fluctuations of the area. And the fact that you get 1 over gamma might not be surprising either, because isn't it true that if you want the classical constraints to look classical, gamma should actually be 0? So the natural value is gamma equals 0, and that's just the standard UV divergences.
No, gamma should be 1, if you want. I mean, first of all, classical constraints are satisfied by any value of gamma, but the most natural value of gamma that comes up, I think that's what you're referring to, for example, the talks we had, is gamma equal to 1.
On the other hand, if I look at your expression for the area, gamma going to 0 and the number of polymers going to infinity is the thing which naturally leads me to a continuum limit.
It's H bar going to zero. I mean, you can also take gamma going to zero or G going
Sorry?
To zero. It's H bar going to zero, right? And this is Planck length squared. And Planck length has G times H bar.
No, the Planck length is dimensional. So A gamma is a dimensionless parameter. Isn't it gamma going to zero that sort of gives me a real continuum with area?
No, in fact, the one value of gamma which is precluded from classical theory is zero.
Is zero.
And positive values are allowed, but zero is not allowed. I mean, the classical framework breaks down at gamma equals zero. But the answer to the first, you get proportion of the area, but the first attempts actually along these lines, which are very, showed us the direction and so on of this work, but which did not really take into account the horizon boundary conditions, therefore did not have the Chern-Simons terms at all, actually got square root of the area and not the area. So it's not totally obvious that one should get area.
Yes, the fact that the degrees of freedom that you have considered and from which you derive the entropy are only associated with the surface of the horizon makes one wonder why the generalized second law should be valid for, let's say, matter outside the black hole and only those degrees of freedom. In some sense, it seems that all the degrees of freedom associated with the gravitational field outside are ignored. No?
Right. So the idea that this is really the gravitational entropy associated with the black hole. So the generalized law should have this plus the entropy of the matter.
I would think it should be those, the entropy of the matter, and the entropy of the gravitational degrees of freedom of the outside of the black hole.
But outside the black hole, right. But the total, I agree with you. But so the gravitational degrees of freedom outside the black hole would be, for example, in the form of gravity waves, because we're not looking at stationary situation up here. Even in the classical theory, there are degrees of freedom of the gravitational field, which are contained in the gravity waves up here. I agree with you that in the thought experiment I could actually take a little bit of entropy in gravity waves and do something with it. So gravity waves I was referring to as matter in the general case. So the idea is that this is the Coulombic part of the gravitational entropy associated with the Coulombic part of the gravitational field, if you like, not with the radiative part of the gravitational field. And the radiative part of the gravitational field, radiation which might exist outside, is to be treated more or less like the matter, I mean, with all the caveats about energy not being locally defined and all that.
There would be no fluctuations, so there would be only one state that is associated with the static.
No, there will be fluctuations, but that will just vary from state to state. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the classical picture, right, in the classical isolated horizon, we don't have a fixed geometry outside. We have all possible mm-hmm. geometry. So there will be fluctuations, but they will vary from one state to another state of the bulk geometry.
One of the features of your talk was that you had a bulk operator and a surface operator, and self-consistently demanded that the eigenvalues of the surface operator be the same as the bulk operator. But another feature was that the eigenvalues of the bulk operator had this one-parameter ambiguity. So to get them to match up, does that mean that the surface also had a corresponding one-parameter ambiguity, or
right.
How does it work?
Thank you. Right. So what happens is that if you look at the symplectic structure, I'll give you the short answer, and if it is not satisfied, I'll give you the longer answer. So the short answer is that the symplectic structure of the surface theory has that one parameter ambiguity. And that is why the bulk operator, that is why the eigenvalues of the field operator in the surface theory, I mean, the eigenvalues of the field operator in the surface theory are essentially immediately determined once you know what the symplectic structure is. And the reason the is that okay, or shall I tell you why the symplectic structure has the ambiguity in it? So, the way that this ambiguity arises in the bulk theory and the surface theory is it is exactly one origin. They both come from exactly the same thing. To begin with, the theory is really, the four-dimensional covariant formulation, etc., which are suppressed here. The theory is really formulated in terms of these self-dual connections, which are SL2C connections, or complex valued SU2 connections, if you like. The reason I'm calling it complex valued SU2 connection is it's a complex valued SU2 connection. Say. Okay. But as John was pointing out, when the gauge group is non-compact, we really do not know yet how to handle that situation. You have to regularize things, and we don't know how to do that. So what we did was to do a trick. We made a canonical transformation on the classical phase space to go to real connections, SU2. It's a real canonical transformation. I mean, you can just check that all the points are black. Everything is okay. So in the original theory, we had a bulk symplectic structure and a surface symplectic structure, and the surface symplectic structure did not know anything about this gamma. The gamma ambiguity comes about precisely because we are going from the complex connections to real connections. You make a certain canonical transformation. When you make that canonical transformation, of course, there's something happens in the bulk, but the symplectic structure on the surface also changes, and it acquires this gamma. It's exactly the same origin, basically. And now when you go to quantum theory, in the bulk theory, this gamma is what is responsible for changing the spectra. It's basically, physically you know what a triad operator should be, but the triad operator may be represented by delta A in one representation, and 1 upon gamma times delta by delta A in another representation. That is what is really giving us all this ambiguity. So it's exactly the same reason that bulk and both of them acquire ambiguity is the same thing.
So if I understood correctly, for a given choice of sort of spin network, for a given choice of punctures in J, the geometry on the horizon is essentially flat with these conical singularities. But that sounds like it's fixed. And now you have presumably more than one Chern-Simon state for a given choice of punctures. So in what sense is this sort of fluctuation of the geometry?
Thank you. These M's are given functions of J, given bunch of J's, M's can vary. And therefore, it's true that the location of the punctures is the same for the geometry. That is the point that you're making.
Right.
But the definite angles are getting distributed very differently.
I see. And for each choice of the M's, you
for
have one state.
Exactly.
Okay. So if I could just follow that up with one quick question. I mean, there is a slight tension here, I guess. You start with this picture where you have the connections on the bulk and also the sort of connection on the boundary. But in the bulk, you sort of argue that everything should be discrete and you go to the spin network basis. But on the horizon, you sort of keep the connection as sort of your basic variable, and you still work very much with this continuum two-surface picture. So do you imagine that there's another description of this where everything on the horizon is also discrete? And
no, there's no tangent, because we're exactly allowing the same distribution of connections in the bulk as we're allowing on the surface. It just turns out that the distributional abelian connections on the surface, let me start from scratch. Okay? We're allowing generalized connections in the sense that I explained before, both on the bulk and the surface, and they really are defined with assigning holonomies, blah, 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 from the beginning. In the bulk, we don't insist that the area operator should be quantized or anything of that sort. What we insist is that that the wave functions be given by square integral functions of this, the generalized connections. Right? In other words, Hilbert space, that is what is given to us. And then on that, we go and find out what the operators are, and then we find some results. Now, in the surface, we come, and we're just looking at connections, which in the bulk are generalized connections. On the surface are also generalized connections. So the idea is that if you give me... So on the surface, there are also generalized connections up here. But then it turns out that once we go and look at that constraint, you probably understand this. So to begin with, we're looking at some states, I mean, we don't know what they are, of the entire thing, which are, here there are surface connections here there are functions of connection, the bulk functions of the connection on the surface up here. And then we want to solve this equation up here. Okay? I'm trying to get a shortcut to say what I want to say. Precise thing will take too long. Okay. Then the statement is that now we conclude here that we would like the generalized connection should be such that the curvature should be distributional. And this is all sort of really singling out a subclass of connections, generalized connections. And these turn out to be there is a one-to-one correspondence between the generalized connections and ordinary distributional connections in the abelian case. And so that works up there. In other words, what I'm trying to say is that there really is a uniform procedure for quantizing. It's not that one changes the rules in the middle.
I was going to ask the question that Aina asked, but I'm still confused about the answer, so I'll ask a follow-up. Is the statement then that just the Chern-Simons U1 theory by itself has the equivalent of an Amirti parameter ambiguity in its quantization then?
No. The Chern-Simons theory doesn't exist until you supply it with a symplectic structure.
It doesn't have a symplectic structure of its own?
Right. I mean, you can always multiply it. Right?
You emphasized the independence of the proportionality factor on charge and lambda, things like that, but it wasn't clear to me how those other parameters might have entered the calculation, because you have a Chern-Simons theory with a fixed spherical boundary and so on. I mean, perhaps it affects the symplectic structure, but that wasn't clear.
So the statement is that... of course, once you have matter fields, you also have boundary conditions of the matter fields, which you have done there in order to get the laws of, in order to get a well-defined action principle and also the black hole laws. So it was just done at the classical level, the isolated horizon boundary conditions. But these boundary conditions, what they tell you is, you can look at it classically, look at it in two different ways. One can just look at it classically. And what one can find is that for this whole coupled system, you can organize things so that the degree of freedom is just in this Chern-Simons connection V that is given to you. Once you know that V, then the intrinsic geometry is determined by this equation up here, and it also is true that those boundary conditions will fix the fields. The degrees of freedom were just put in V up here, if you like, and there are no independent degrees of freedom in the matter field by itself. But one can just say that, okay, so classically, one can say I can just eliminate those degrees of freedom classically. But even if one didn't do that, one just sort of kept those degrees of freedom. They're not there, but what we have is only the relation between the Chern-Simons thing, the triad thing, and the matter things. We've got all these things. And we just here took a viewpoint to put the degrees of freedom there. But now let's suppose that I don't take that viewpoint, right? I mean, I'd say that, let me keep the relations, just as I kept relations here between the bulk operator and the surface operator in the gravitational case, let me keep the relation also in the matter degrees of freedom. There's some relation, and I replace it by quantum operators. In other words, this is eliminating some degrees of freedom classically versus imposing some quantum boundary condition. When you do that, you find that when you have matter field associated with each of these solutions, so now I'll get tensor product of this with some matter thing up here. As soon as I solve that, the matter state is completely determined. In other words, this quantum calculation just reflects what we knew classically, that we don't really get new degrees of freedom. All that is happening is that when you count the surface degrees of freedom, instead of saying that you just have this Chern-Simons state, there is really a tensor product, it's like a Chern-Simons state multiplied by matter state. But the matter state, once you told me what the Chern-Simons state is, then the matter state is given to me. So I don't get more degrees of freedom.
Okay. Just one quick follow-up. When you do the charge case, you would count at states with area, you know, within your epsilon bounds of A naught or whatever that was. When you do charge case, do you also constrain the charge to lie between two values?
Right. Just a quick remark before you. Somehow for this whole philosophy and also the way mathematical technicalities work, in these isolated horizons, normally one sort of thinks of the black holes, parameterizing them with mass and charges and angular momentum, etc. Here it seems, in order to get the quasi-local description, because I don't know what the mass of the black hole is quasi-locally, if there is radiation outside and so on, it seems to be that the quasi-local description is best suited suggests that we should parameterize the black hole to the area, which is constant because of the boundary condition, and then charges and perhaps angular momentum up here. And think of the mass of the Hamiltonian as a derived quantity up here. That was what was necessary in the classical theory in order to get the laws, etc., etc. And that is what seems to be also permeating up here. There are subtle differences which are surprising for me. I mean, we're always used to thinking of mass as a basic parameter and expressing everything in terms of that.
You say up there in your summary that your treatment includes cosmological horizons as well as black hole horizons. So I'm not used to thinking about the thermodynamics of a cosmological horizon, apart from the K, I guess that plays some role. But wondering, does one learn something about, is there a thermodynamics for such cosmology? And do you learn anything about quantum cosmology in any sense?
So this is just as for ordinary black hole horizons, they are not, thermodynamics of those things was not done in the framework of quantum gravity. It was done in the framework of quantum field theory on a given background. Similarly, the cosmological horizons were treated in the same framework of quantum field theory on cosmological backgrounds. And again, I mean, there is. This paper actually came out surprisingly just a year after 1975, basically, a paper of Hawking and Gibbons and many other people about.
A question about extension of this kind of work. You presented two results here. One is the definition of isolated horizon, which has an interest, if I understand correctly, in the classical theory by itself independently from the rest. And the second is you showed how one can understand the entropy for those horizons. In other words, you understand how this notion is sufficient for then understanding in the quantum theory the entropy. Now my question is this notion necessary to understanding this entropy? And the reason I'm asking that is at the light of construction like Grindler, or more interesting what Ted Jacobson has shown, that in a rather precise, also obscure, I would say, sense, one can associate a entropy to horizon like the Grindler, I don't know how to call it, event horizon of an accelerating observer. So it seems that in some sense an entropy is associated to those horizons as well. Do you expect that this kind of same technology could be extended to those cases, or those cases should be out from this?
For your meta question, I'm sitting on a fence, and I'll explain. But for the technical part, I can just answer. I recently realized that one can actually hope to explain at least the classical part of this thing to include this acceleration kind of horizons. I'm not saying that we have done it, but sort of in the beginning, I was sort of pretty stuck. The problem is the following, that in order to get these laws of isolated horizon mechanics, you know, the generalized black hole mechanics, we had to assume that the topology was S2 cross R. And that is not the case. I mean, that was critical in some, I mean, we like to use like Gauss-Bonnet theorem and so on. So in order to, for example, get the constancy of temperature. So for a while I thought that, well, I don't know how to really fix it at all. But just, you know, last month or so, I sort of feel that one might be able to, well, I see a way of going about doing that. So this is the technical part. Then the meta question about, you know, should one associate entropy with those things? I'm not at all convinced that one should associate entropy with those things at all, basically. I mean, I sort of feel that, you know, I take a two-sphere in Minkowski space, and I don't want to associate the entropy with a two-sphere in Minkowski space. Once a horizon is formed, and sort of isolated horizon is formed, then it might expand. I can associate entropy here, I can associate entropy there, because it really is, I don't know, it's something that I cannot verbalize very clearly because I haven't... because it is not clear in my mind, but my prejudice is that, at this stage, my prejudice is really that one should not do that, yes.
But there is something clear here, that there is a sense of an approximation in this calculation, the sense of why are you treating a black hole as a classical boundary in a quantum theory, which may make sense here in the sense that if you have a large black hole, most of the modes are dominated by whatever is outside, whereas for these other horizons, that notion is less clear. What is large?
No, large is just area is large compared to the Planck length. I mean, all these horizons have, these horizons, yeah. I agree with you, right. The cosmological horizons, one knows what is large, because any time it's S2 cross R, you know what is large.
You got the Chern-Simons term because you wanted to have the differentiability of the Hamiltonian. What happens if you get if you take other boundaries, not those satisfying
the isolated
horizon condition? Doesn't differentiability force you into some sort of a boundary term, and can't you make for that boundary term the same argument that it should be associated with the entropy of the surface?
Yeah, I think this is the kind of calculation that I would like to do, you know, before I jump the fence one way or the other completely. But I think if you just ask in general, just want to put some boundary, what can I make the action differentiable? The answer is probably no. There are two things that one wants to know. Is the action differentiable? Is the resulting Hamiltonian framework, does it have a well-defined symplegic structure? It's only while doing this calculation I realize that differentiability of action technically is actually a weaker condition than asking that the symplegic structure be well-defined, and I can explain to you that later. So one wants the symplegic structure to be well-defined, and then one also would like to make sure that this is not an empty theory, that there are enough solutions with those boundary conditions. So I think one... Well, I mean, so case by case, one can look and see if one can make the action differentiable. But I don't have a general recipe for that. But again, if you are referring explicitly to acceleration horizons that Carlo is referring to, yeah, so that's what one would do typically. These acceleration horizons go all the way to infinity. So I'm not sure about how to go about doing these things.
What is it technically that forced you? Into the Chern-Simons action on the boundary.
It is the following. So we assume the isolated horizon boundary conditions, and the key thing that is being assumed is really that the expansion of this L vector is equal to zero, which is what one has. But technically there are also conditions on the other null vector N, which were imposed, which I can motivate. But if once you put these boundary conditions on the shear and expansion, etc., then it turns out that the curvature is very highly constrained. And the curvature is essentially, I mean, what I wrote down here is really one small consequence of the general relation you get between the curvature and the self-dual two forms. Everything is done in terms of the self-dual connection. There are self-dual two forms, sigma, you probably know that. And the curvature is highly constrained. There is a very tight relation which comes from this expansion shear between these two things. And then, knowing that, you go and do the variation of the action without the Chern-Simons term, see what is left over. And then you see immediately that because of this tight constraint between the curvature and the self-dual forms, that what you need to add is it exactly the Chern-Simons state. In other words, what is left is really the variation of something, and you can stare at it and see explicitly that it's the Chern-Simons state.
Hi. In your talk, you made a distinction between your approach and the D-brain approach by saying that the D-brain approach was really based, the D-brain's and Yang-Mill theory, a sort of matter approach, whereas yours is intrinsically the quantum geometry of space-time. I'd like to point out that distinction is not really correct. That they really are due to duality, if you like, as Joe talked about. It's really is quantum geometry. They're not really...
I think the word quantum geometry is used in many, many different senses. I agree that this is first transparency, and it was an introductory remark up here.
Sure.
And so it was a zeroth order remark, right? I mean, okay, but the word duality, for example, when people talk about Joe, well, I mean, I forget exactly, Joe mentioned this in his talk, or whether it was in one of our lunch seminar just last week. But for example, when one talks about mirror symmetry or something, one is talking there about classical topology changing. So it is certainly true that some process which is not normally take place in general relativity is said to take place in this particular case. But still, at any one stage, the geometry that you have is ordinary differential geometry. There is nothing distributional anywhere, in this passage. The word quantum geometry here, so in other words, whereas here, when one talks about quantum geometry, it really is that we don't have differential geometry. We don't, there is no metric. There are no holomorphic vector fields. There are none of those things appearing here. So I was really referring to that kind of aspect.
Yes, that issue is interesting, but I don't think relevant to the issue of trying to identify degrees of freedom to which you would ascribe an entropy.
Okay.
In that issue, I would say that D-brains are just a way that we use to evaluate gravitational degrees of freedom internal to the black hole.
All right. So, but would you agree that, or not, that the forefront way of putting these degrees of freedom, the calculable, obvious way of putting these degrees of freedom is in D-brains, and these D-brains carry stress on your tensor, and that is why that is matter.
Yeah, it's a dual picture, but yeah.
Dual picture to what?
To the.
Is it not true that one cannot pinpoint the gravitational degrees of freedom, which are accounting for this entropy, except we are going through deep brains? The U1 Chern-Simons theory, I mean, maybe you step out of it, is that
if you want, it's just that duality is just a calculational tool.
Right. So maybe I should say the obvious way of, I'm agreeing with the viewpoints, everything. So what I'm saying is that the way that the calculation is done, the understanding of the degrees of freedom, because of duality, they could be put in the gravitational field or in the matter sector, if you like, and that distinction is... It's at a fundamental conceptual level, is not right. I mean, that's just degrees of freedom. That's what you're saying, I think.
It's almost semantics, but
right.
Semantics can be important. And in this case, I would say it's just dangerous to call it matter. That's my crucial point.
Right.
It really is, it's a different tool via duality. It's a different way of enumerating the degrees of freedom of the same physical system.
Okay, so...
In that sense, it's dangerous to call it matter.
Okay, so let me
but
get that.
But it's semantics.
No, but I think it's good to get this straight. So it's just because I might say similar things somewhere else, and I don't want to make you
unhappy. That's what I was worried about.
so let me just sort of make sure that, if you have objection against saying that the calculable place, the place where one has control on degrees of freedom, is in the deep brains. It is true that through duality, these degrees of freedom would also correspond to degrees of freedom in the gravitational field. But one does not have direct control on the gravity side to single out those degrees of freedom?
We have control in the sense that we can make a sharp statement via duality. So in that sense, we do have control. The problem is you've used the word obvious in a couple of places, and that's unfair, I think.
Okay, negative statement at all.
If you allow me to use a little bit of supersymmetry in some cases where we can be very sharp, then I do believe we have control via tracking BPS states. And then we absolutely have control. And then we extrapolate and we declare that there's probably a duality. So in that limited sense, where we use supersymmetry as a crutch, I would say we do have control. Well, we do the calculation where we can. I see what he's saying, but it's not the same as calling it matter.
This has been extremely good for me, I mean, to learn this thing. But I just want to clarify that I was not objecting, and I was not saying it in any bad way.
I just wanted
to draw a distinction for the mathematicians and astronomers in this audience who saw similar pictures in the last talk,
right.
I just want to have some words that, you know...
Right. We have a limited number of pictures, but... Indeed, you should draw the distinction, but I didn't want it to be made too clear, because maybe we will find out one day that they aren't as different as they seem.
Right.
Well, several outstanding questions, but I'm afraid we are out of time. So I think we should call off the official thing here, and those who want to continue.